Welcome to Redmond Radio, the weekly podcast updating you on the latest IT news to come out of Redmond. In this week's episode, Microsoft questions legal judgment in Word patent case, Hotmail accounts are getting hijacked, says Microsoft, and a report on Windows 7 and business. Also, how the healthcare debate is fueling spam. We'll get right to it after this quick musical interlude right here on Redmond Radio. Welcome to Redmond Radio. I'm your host, Michael Domingo. As always, I welcome your feedback on this show at mdomingo@1105media.com. That's mdomingo@1105media.com. If you want to send a quick shout-out on my voicemail, call me at 949-265-1564. That's a toll call since you'll be calling Irvine. You can also catch the show on Redmond Radio. .podbean.com. That's redmondradio.podbean.com if you want to download the show automatically via iTunes. The Podbean version contains a little bit more information on the show, mainly the IT web gems, and once in a while I have contests that are only available by looking at the description page at redmondradio.podbean.com. Redmond Radio listeners via the Podbean version can find out how to win an MCP MagCap, for example. So check that out. And in case you're wondering, no one won a cap a few weeks ago, but there is a cap this week. So your chances are incredibly good if you listen right now. There was only one entry last week. Microsoft filed legal papers a week ago Tuesday, appealing a final judgment against it in a patent infringement case brought by I4I LP. The case concerns I4I's XML-based technology, which received patent number 5787449 from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office in 1998. At stake are sales of Microsoft Word in the U.S. markets, which will be enjoined according to the final judgment. But Microsoft's appeal states that the ruling will affect all versions of Word and Office currently available. Microsoft can't distribute copies of Word containing I4I's patented custom XML technology, according to the ruling by a U.S. District Court judge, who confirmed a jury verdict. The prohibition on Word sales takes place 60 days from the judge's ruling, around October 10th. Microsoft's appeal, filed with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit Court, essentially argues that the district court's judge was incompetent as a gatekeeper and in striking the delicate balance needed in patent law disputes. The appeal states, that balance can be lost if the district court does not protect the process and patent litigation then becomes a tax on innovation rather than its guardian. In a release statement, I4I Chairman Loudon Owen commented on Microsoft's appeal. He stated, it captures the hostile attitude of Microsoft toward inventors who dare to enforce patents against them. It is also blatantly derogatory about the court system. According to the Microsoft appeal, I4I's patent was only disclosed to a handful of Microsoft employees in some marketing materials. Microsoft later came out with a version of Word with functionality similar to I4I's patent. The patent doesn't apply to older Office document formats such as Doc and Dot. Rather, it applies to XML document formats XML, DocX and DocM that contain custom XML, according to page 11 of the Microsoft's brief. I4I's patent describes a mapping system that stores metadata separately from the content of the XML document, but Microsoft's appeal disputes that Word uses this technology. Microsoft claims irreparable and immediate losses for the company if the judgment is upheld. The company was ordered by the district court to pay more than $240 million in damages and other penalties. Microsoft appeals ask for a reversal of the judgment and a finding of non-infringement. Otherwise, Microsoft is requesting a new trial. Toronto-based I4I plans to issue a response to Microsoft's appeal on September 7th. Oral arguments in the appeal are scheduled for September 23rd. Microsoft's position is being supported by amicus filings by Dell and HP, according to Microsoft's press agency. Microsoft started a new pilot help program a few weeks ago for IT professionals and developers facing application compatibility issues. The program, which is part of Microsoft's advisory services, provides phone support for those having difficulties with product migration, code review, or new program development. Those beset by such problems need to be prepared to open the wall to get such support, though. Microsoft's advisory services cost about $210 an hour and is available for up to 20 hours. The program doesn't provide any on-site support. Before providing assistance, Microsoft typically asks IT pros or developers a series of questions about the type of applications involved, operating systems used, and the compatibility problems experienced. Microsoft's engineers then run a series of tools. Microsoft's engineers then run a series of tools to try to determine why the application compatibility problems are happening. One of those tools is the Application Compatibility Toolkit, which checks on third-party applications running on Vista or Windows 7. Another tool is the Internet Explorer Compatibility Test Tool, which checks IE7 and IE8 compatibility. Microsoft also runs a setup analysis tool to check Windows installers and third-party installers. A standard user analyzer tool is used to check application programming interface compatibility with a Windows 7 security feature called User Account Control, or UAC. Finally, to test if applications will work with the next version of Windows, Microsoft provides its Compatibility Administrator tool. Microsoft has already released Windows 7 to equipment vendors, partners, and IT pros who subscribe to MSDN and TechNet services. The general public release of Windows 7 is scheduled for October 22nd. Microsoft pointed to email account hijacking as becoming an increasing problem, especially among Windows Live Hotmail users. In a blog post on Monday, the company warned that some Windows Live Hotmail users have noticed that their accounts had been hijacked by spammers. Users can log into hijacked accounts, but they unwillingly share them with a hacker. According to Microsoft, a hijacked user account would allow a hacker to send emails to the user's contacts, which could result in both the user and those contacts unwittingly downloading worms into a workstation. From there, such malware can spread to the network. Windows Live Hotmail, the email service that powers Office Live, Small Business, and other services such as Google's Gmail and Yahoo Mail, may be vectors for such attacks. Security experts say this vector is among the most common client-side entry points for malware. Users are more likely to open and act upon an email out of curiosity and then click on a link. They're also more likely to open email from someone they know. The value of stolen or hijacked email accounts has always been huge, according to Paul Henry, security and forensic analyst at Lumentum. He said that initially all you needed was to brute force the user's passwords. Now, when you factor in the automation and organization of today's cyber criminals, seeing mass hijacking of email accounts is simply a regular occurrence. Randy Abrams, Director of Technical Education at ESET, suggested that users of Microsoft's online services need better security information. He said where Windows Live was correct in advising to obtain the most recent virus definitions, a non-technical person at Office Live translated that to stay up to date on the latest computer viruses going around. But staying up to date on the latest computer viruses doesn't really help, he said. You need to understand the concepts to avoid them. There are too many threats to keep up with them all, he said. Symantec's State of Spam report, released earlier this month, found that spam accounted for 89% of all emails messaged in July. The spam rate for August was even more dire, according to a recent MXLogic report, which found that up to 94.9% of all email messages were spam. Spam that delivers images and links continues to have impact, accounting for 70% of all spam in July, according to Symantec's report. A new version of 419 spam has appeared in which spammers try to exploit VoIP services, according to Symantec. The company describes 419 spam as a message that alerts users about money they supposedly either inherited or won. The Social Security Administration has entered into an agreement to test the use of Microsoft Health Vault software for SSA's disability determination process. SSA has been trying several ways to electronically collect the health records of people applying for disability income. SSA currently requests about 15 to 20 million medical records a year in a process that is labor and paper intensive. Health Vault is a free online personal health records service in which patients are encouraged to collect and store their health information in a single location. The SSA said that it's working with Microsoft in developing a technical prototype connecting the two organizations that will be available later this year. SSA also will collaborate with Microsoft to study current personal health record standards, gaps in those standards, and options for filling those gaps. The SSA has been using the Health and Human Services Department's Nationwide Health Information Network to link with providers for the purpose of getting the disability records for now. The agency recently issued a request for information asking vendors to propose how to link more provider records through the NHIN. SSA also is working with MedVirginia to test sharing of digital patent records in that state. According to Michael Cherry, Vice President of Research on Operating Systems for Directions on Microsoft, Microsoft got it right with Windows 7. Cherry, along with colleagues Paul DeGroote and Matt Rossoff, have produced a research report aimed at helping senior IT decision makers evaluate Microsoft's latest client OS. The 40-page report will be available next month. Cherry said in a telephone interview, "It was really important for this version of Windows to overcome the barriers put up by Vista, and I think they successfully accomplished that." Those barriers, according to the report, include poor application compatibility, poor device driver support, and of course the infamous user account control security feature, among others. 2 years after Vista was released, more than 70% of business computers were still running XP, according to Forrester Research. Windows 7 is a somewhat slimmed-down interim OS release, according to Cherry. Like Vista, Windows 7 shares the same code base for server and client, allowing simplified testing for Microsoft and much improved maintenance for customers. A single service pack can be used to update both server and client. While the core components of Vista and Windows 7 are the same, the improved performance of the new OS may alter perceptions that had turned negative with Vista, according to the report. Said Cherry, "I think the biggest surprise for me was when I saw a Microsoft executive hold up a netbook at a recent conference saying it was running Windows 7. There's no way you could run Vista on a box like that," he said. Changes with Windows 7 include improved driver support, a streamlined UAC, an updated service control manager, a new power management system, and a simplified BitLocker. We'll continue with more news in a second. Let's break for this message from 1105 Media. VS Live is the educational conference for the VisualStudio.net developer, looking for up-to-date, relevant technical content on today's most critical topics. Each VS Live conference offers a unique set of topics designed to provide cutting-edge techniques to help you solve development challenges today and help you build the next-generation applications for tomorrow. VS Live takes place in Orlando, Florida, October 4th through the 7th. Find out more and register at vslive.com. And welcome back to Redmond Radio. All right, let's get back to some news. Looking to address a key objection to hosting data in the cloud, Amazon said it will offer a more secure iteration of its EC2 service. Amazon's virtual private cloud will let enterprises extend their existing networks using IPsec-based VPN connections to create their own logically isolated Amazon EC2 instances. Regarded as the largest and most influential provider of cloud services, Amazon said its new Amazon VPC is available for beta testing. The company bills it as a bridge between an organization's existing IT systems and the AWS cloud, allowing them to tie their systems to AWS via a standard VPN connection. That allows them to create their own IP address space, thereby extending security and intrusion detection to the Amazon cloud. To create a VPC in Amazon, developers or administrators can define a private IP address space consisting of any IPv4 address range, including private address spaces identified by RFC 1918 or any other routable IP address block, according to Jeff Barr, Amazon's lead web services evangelist. From there, the developer can partition the IP address space into any number of subnets. Customers can create up to 20 subnets per VPC, though they can request more, said Barr. For a standard VPN connection, it's 5 cents per hour. Inbound data transfer is 10 cents per gigabyte of data, and outbound data transfer starts at 17 cents per gigabyte for the first 10 terabytes per month, scaling down to 10 cents for more than 150 terabytes. The expected growth rate in Linux server operating system subscriptions and non-paid deployments is expected to slow to just 1.1% over the next 5 years, according to a report released early last week. Contraction in server sales in 2009 is largely to blame for the declining compound annual growth rate of Linux servers, according to the report released by IDC. The economic downturn is a key contributor, but will have a lasting impact looking forward, according to the report. The report comes just a month after IDC released another forecast, finding the economy and reduced IT budgets are aiding the growth of overall open-source initiatives. But contributing to the declining growth rate of Linux in particular is the increase in deployments of hypervisors and virtualized deployments that are reducing the number of overall servers. IDC is also forecasting weak growth for Microsoft's Windows Server in the next 5 years. That according to IDC analyst Al Gillen in an interview. That doesn't say that products are going away. We expect the growth to be in the low to mid single digits through the forecast period, he said. Anytime you have any, even if it's zero growth, it still indicates the same number of units are shipped. While subscriptions are down, overall revenue growth associated with Linux system software will decline in the coming 5 years to a compounded annual growth rate of 16.9%, down from 23.7% between 2007 and 2009. Revenues from Linux are expected to hit the $1 billion threshold in 2012. The report also found that Red Hat and Novell accounted for nearly 95% of worldwide Linux revenues in 2008, with the two accounting for 90% of new server operating subscriptions last year. Non-paid Linux server deployments last year accounted for 43.3% of deployments, up from 41.4% in 2007. For its part, Linux is a catalyst for Novell's growth. The company reported its Linux revenues of $38 million, which is an increase of 22% for its third fiscal quarter ended July 31st, over the same period last year, despite an overall revenue decline of 12%, which is totaling $216 for the period. Zoho is making further inroads in the online office market with the introduction of a unified login mechanism that allows users to use their Google and Yahoo ID to access Zoho's suite of office-like apps. This latest development follows a series of offerings announced last month by the Boston, Massachusetts, and Pleasanton, California-based online business application provider. In July, the company released a plugin for Microsoft Access and Zoho Office for Microsoft Office SharePoint. Citing a recent New York Times article, a Zoho spokesperson said Zoho is giving Google and Microsoft a run for their money in the online office market by making it even easier for people to try its suite of online business apps. But Zoho evangelist Raju Vigesna stated in an email that the company is not looking to migrate users from Google, but rather to complement Google Apps users with a broad range of productivity, collaboration, and business offerings online. Zoho's unified login is a standards-based single sign-on technology that unites all Zoho apps, according to Vigesna. Microsoft last month announced an SSO claims-based identity management server platform, Active Directory Federation Services, formerly codenamed Geneva, which will be available in the second half of 2009. Gary Gable, an analyst at the Burton Group, said at the time that the ADFS platform is important for Microsoft because it will be used to establish connections with Microsoft's Windows Azure platform, supporting hosted applications such as SharePoint Online and Exchange Online. Gable stated in an email that Zoho is using OpenID for Google, Google Apps, and Yahoo, not the Federation standard supported in ADFS. Vigesna confirmed by email that Google had opened its system to allow Zoho to offer login using Google as an option. He said, with Google opening this up for Google Apps, we were able to extend our previous implementation. In a previous statement, Vigesna reiterated that Zoho's efforts were not meant to convert users from other providers, but to complement competitor applications. He added that Zoho offers business applications that are not available from other vendors. We have two more security-related items. Spam volumes have increased fourfold during the last 6 months, and the unsolicited and often malicious messages account for a discouraging 94.9% of all email delivered so far in August. That according to the most recent report from online security company MXLogic. Healthcare was the most common category for spam in August. An increasing number of bogus pharmacies are using image spam, in which the message is included in an image rather than text in an effort to avoid spam filters. The lure of cut-rate, no-prescription pharmaceuticals appears to be powerful. Spam watchdog groups say that phony pharmacies predominate in online advertising delivered through Microsoft's Bing search engine. According to a report from the anti-spam site NudgeOn and LegitScript, which validates legitimate pharmacies advertising online, nearly 90% of internet pharmacy advertisements delivered on Bing.com that were reviewed were operating illegally. Microsoft responded to the report saying that the results were exaggerated and that it had manually reviewed and removed the offending ads. But NudgeOn and LegitScript said later that a review of the search engine's advertisers showed that phony ads continued to appear. MXLogic predicted that internet pharmacy advertising will not be the only threat generated by healthcare concerns. The threat report warned, as the debate about U.S. healthcare reform continues to heat up, we believe there's a strong chance this will increase and we'll begin seeing forms of political hacktivism impacting the performance and availability of popular social network sites. Attacks against social network sites advocating either side of the debate could have ripple effects affecting the services hosting the sites. Malicious e-greeting card notifications remained a popular type of spam in the last month, but phony UPS or DHL invoices were the most popular method for delivering malware directly, accounting for 4 out of 5 instances in which malware was attached to an email. The U.S. was the top source of spam over the past month, accounting for 13.3%, edging out Brazil with 13%. Other top sources were India, Ukraine, and Poland. And finally, the rapid morphing and bundling of exploits for known vulnerabilities could be the biggest concern for security experts, but that doesn't mean that new threats are not emerging. Two of the most troubling are in the domain name system and secure sockets layer services users have trusted for years. A zero-day exploit emerged late last month for a vulnerability in one of the most commonly used DNS servers, forcing many users to update the software that helps to direct internet traffic. Branko Miskov, product manager, director at Blue Cat Network, said pretty much any Bind 9 server can be brought down with this script. Our development team was quite surprised at how simple this was. Also last month, researchers demonstrated exploits using fraudulent X509 certificates against SSL, the web protocol for securing sessions between servers and clients. SSL is an almost transparent scheme that underlies many financial and other secure transactions via the internet. Booz Allen Hamilton Vice President George Shue said that was a system that worked very well and has given us a sense of security over the years. Recent developments, though, indicate that these guys are getting really clever and looking for new ways to do harm, he said. DNS is a protocol for associating domain names with the numerical IP addresses that are used to direct internet traffic. DNS underlies almost all internet activity. Bind, or originally the Berkeley Internet Name Domain, is a widely used open source DNS software that likely is being used on more than half of the world's public DNS servers. The Internet Systems Consortium, which maintains Bind, announced in July that an exploit already was in wide circulation for a vulnerability which can cause servers running Release 9 of the software to crash. According to ISC, when those versions of Bind 9 are configured as a master server, the receipt of a specially crafted dynamic update message can cause the server to crash. ISC's alert states, testing indicates that the attack packet has to be formulated against a zone for which that machine is a master. Launching the attack against slave zones does not trigger the crash. They add that this vulnerability affects all servers that are masters for one or more zones. It's not limited to those that are configured to allow dynamic updates. In many ways, crashing a DNS server is a less serious attack than cache poisoning, which can redirect traffic to malicious sites. A flaw in the DNS protocols that could allow cache poisoning was announced last summer. But the current Bind flaw is serious because it's easy to exploit. ISC rated this vulnerability at high severity, largely because of the existence of a zero-day exploit. The National Institute of Standards and Technology's National Vulnerability Database rates it at a medium severity, with a low rating for its impact, but a high rating for its exploitability. Problems with the X509 digital certificate standard were discussed by two researchers at last month's Black Hat briefings. Because the X509 standard is not specific enough, and vendors implement it differently in their products, it's possible to fool web browsers into accepting certificates that are invalid or not for the server to which the client is being directed. In special presentations at the Computer Security Conference, Dan Kaminsky, Director of Penetration Testing at IOActive, and hacker and yachtsman Moxie Marlinspike of ThoughtCrime.org demonstrated similar exploits against SSL. Mozilla already has incorporated the fix in version 3.5 of its Firefox browser. And hopefully you enjoyed this show this week, but that's it for this week's Redmond Radio. Before we go, I definitely would love to say thanks once again to all you listeners who continue to support Redmond Radio by streaming and downloading this program, and especially those who pass this show on to their colleagues. I'm Michael Domingo. I'll chat with you next week right here on Redmond Radio.